We've had some rather interesting questions on, or verses on, what does that mean over the last several weeks, ranging from those in the New Testament, a couple of which reference rather obscure books that we generally don't read because they're found in the Apocrypha or they're found in other non-canonical writings. Some that perhaps we've read and not really thought about in the past, but someone did because they wrote it down and dropped it in the box. And some from the Old Testament, which, if most of us were to admit it, we spend far less time reading things out of the Old Testament than we do the New. Variety of reasons for that. I have to admit, some parts of the Old Testament are not that exciting. They're certainly not as exciting as some things going on in the New Testament, and yet some of the things in the New Testament, if we really sit down and read them and think about them, as we were talking about this morning, will disturb us just as much as some of the things we read in the Old Testament. And yet in the Old Testament we find a lot of things. A lot of folks, if you ask them, when you hear Old Testament, what do you think about? And they'll either say miracles or judgment. Miracles or judgment. And more people will say judgment than they will miracles. And we do find some of that, though we find some of that in the New Testament as well. However, in the Hebrew Scriptures or the Old Testament, we also find talk about redemption. Right from the very beginning in the book of Genesis. And in a lot of other places, we find redemption. And we find grace. And we find the remnant of God's people. And sometimes we find that it's very tough to live as that remnant. Now, why am I rambling on about all of this? Because Malachi chapter 3 talks about some of that and talks about how sometimes the remnant, and Malachi is the last book in the Old Testament, or the last one listed, talks about that remnant that is not always faithfully found among the religious leaders, much less the people. And it talks about judgment. Malachi talks a good bit about judgment and justice. But he also talks about the hope for a coming messenger and for the day of the Lord when we can be redeemed and cleansed enough to be a part of God's redemption and God's justice. And we're not talking just about justice in the form of judgment, but we're also talking about justice as in being treated justly by God and therefore treating others, including God, justly. Some weeks ago, the message came from Malachi, from the beginning of the book as well as part of chapter 3, where he talks about how sometimes we don't treat God justly, much less each other, but we don't even treat God justly. So we come then to Malachi chapter 3, and don't recognize the handwriting. I know it's not mine, because sometimes even I can't read it. But I don't recognize the handwriting. But Malachi 3:3. He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. And he will purify the descendants of Levi and refine them like gold and silver until they present offerings to the Lord in righteousness. We'll look at that verse. But we'll look at it within the overall context of the beginning of chapter 3 and what goes right before it. By the way, in case you're wondering, you know, I've never read that before, but I've heard it somewhere. Somebody other than Phyllis, tell me where you've heard it before. You've heard it. You've heard it before. If you've listen to certain things around Christmas time or Easter time, you heard He is like a refiner's fire. And He will purify the sons of Levi. Handel's Messiah. If you've ever listened to the whole thing or gone to a presentation. He is like a refiner's fire. And actually it's a bass. Predominantly a bass solo. For He is like a refiner's fire. A refiner's fire. And He will purify the sons of Levi when the choir comes in and joins the bass. Speaking out of that, it inspired Handel to use that looking toward the messenger, that is, Jesus, coming as that messenger and the purifier, the refiner. However, at the time this was written, Malachi probably wasn't seeing a vision of Jesus off in the future. But he was hopeful for a Messiah that would come and a messenger that would precede that, based in part on some of the theology of the time. And the coming day of the Lord, a day of judgment and justice, when God would come and sit like the refiner and judge not just the world, but start by judging the sons of Levi. By the way, who are the sons of Levi? That's right, the priests. The sons of Levi are the priests, the religious leaders. And I have contended for a long, long time, especially with Isaiah. And if you look back when Isaiah showed up one Sunday a couple of years ago, he talked about how one of the biggest problems with all the social ills was the lack of proper priestly response to God and proper leading by the religious leaders of his day. So, Malachi has just spoken at the end of chapter 2, in fact throughout chapter 2, has spoken about God's justice and God's judgment. And in fact, he talks about it again later in chapter 3 when he talks about them robbing God by not bringing the tithes into the storehouse, and that brings a curse upon them and will make their soil barren and their vines barren as God's judgment and justice. But at the end of chapter 2, in verse 17, he says, "You have wearied the Lord with your words." Imagine we weary God. So you've wearied the Lord. You've wearied God. You've made God tired of dealing with you with your words. Yet you say, how have we wearied Him? By saying, "All who do evil are good in the sight of the Lord, and He delights in them," or by asking, "Where is the God of justice?" They've gotten things confused in their time. And they had gotten to the point where they thought, if you went to the temple and you did the sacrifice and you gave the sacrifice and the tithes at the proper time and the proper amount, it didn't matter if you cheated in business. It didn't matter if you ran roughshod over the poor and the destitute. It didn't matter, as long as you didn't commit murder, it pretty much didn't matter what you did. As long as you did the religious ritual, you were okay, you were covered. And that's what he means in part here when he says, "For you've said, all those people who are doing evil are really good in the sight of the Lord." Why? Because they come and they pay their dues, so to speak. And then they go on about whatever they do. What they did on the Sabbath didn't make a hill of beans with the way they lived Sunday through Friday afternoon. And he said, by asking, "You keep talking about this God of justice. You keep talking about the judgment of God. Where is He? We hadn't seen it. We're still prospering. We haven't seen it. Where is this God of yours?" Taunting God, in some senses, by not believing that God would bring justice upon them. So he has just dealt with that, and he says, just because you've not seen God's justice yet, it's still going to come. And God is still going to come and purify the remnant of His people. He will purify the nation. And when we purify things, especially with fire, and he talks here, he's like a refiner's fire. What do you do with fire? How does fire purify something? What does it do? Okay, it refines out the dross, the things, the impurities get burned up in the heat of the moment, in the heat of the fire. And so he says, you know, you're thinking judgment hadn't come. Well, it's going to come, and it's not going to be easy. In fact, getting you back to being righteous is not going to be an easy task. Why? Because in part of our human nature. But in part because the people had become so complacent here. In the time of Malachi, they had become so complacent about God and what God would and wouldn't do, and their position in God's eyes, or so they thought. They become so complacent that, oh, everything's easy as long as we go and give God the sacrifice, give God whatever, give God a little bit of our time on the Sabbath. That covers it. We can do whatever else we want to do. And Malachi here is telling them that's not true. And you keep thinking that the day of the Lord is going to be a time where your enemies are going to be destroyed. And that was much of their theology as well. When the day of the Lord came, the Yom Yahweh, when God came and resurrected His people into their proper place, it was going to be bad news for all their enemies and great news for them. And what Malachi is telling them here is, it's not going to be that easy and that pleasant. Because what's going to happen is you're going to have to look at where you really have all the dross, where you really have all the impurities, and they're going to have to be brought out, and that may be in difficult days and difficult times. And you may even question whether you're God's chosen ones or not. That's what he's saying to them here, because they had gotten so complacent about whose they were. I know we don't do that today in a Christian church. There are no people in the Christian church who get complacent about who they are and whose they are, right? But that's what he was talking about there. And so, he comes in chapter 3 and says, for God, see then, I am sending my messenger to prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. The messenger of the covenant in whom you delight. Indeed, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. Does this sound familiar? Sending my messenger, preparing the way of the Lord. Ministry of John the Baptist later on. But who can endure the day of his coming, and who can stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's fire, like fuller's soap. He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. And he will purify the descendants of Levi and refine them like gold and silver until they present offerings to the Lord in righteousness. He says God will arrive. God's not going to sit back all the time. God will arrive and be present among you to bring justice and righteousness. And that arrival will be preceded by the coming of the messenger. Now later on, that messenger, as we've already mentioned, in the time of Jesus, that messenger was seen by the New Testament writers as John the Baptizer, John the Baptist, who came preparing the way of the Lord, who talked about Jesus, and who talked about how the day of judgment was coming. And that messenger will come to purify the temple and the temple practices, the religion, and the priesthood. The second part of God correcting injustice is in the actual coming of the Lord Himself to purify the people and to judge them. It's interesting, by the way, would anyone care to take a guess as to what the single Hebrew word that means my messenger is? Yes, Anne? Malachi. Malachi means my messenger. Which has led some people to think, ah, Malachi the prophet is the messenger. And in his day he was. But we also have to remember that with the prophets, there were always more levels to what they said than even they realized oftentimes. There had to be at least a partial fulfillment of the message near the time in which they spoke to show its validity. But that did not mean that God was limited to what they thought. It's just like when Isaiah speaks about, to us a son is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders, and his name will be Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And upon the throne of David to sit and rule with justice and righteousness from this time forth and forevermore, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. Isaiah wasn't having a vision of the birth of Jesus several hundred years later. He thought it was going to be Hezekiah. And the people thought it was going to be King Hezekiah. And for a while, Hezekiah was like that, and then Hezekiah disappointed them. But that did not limit what God did much later with Jesus. But part of what speaks to the validity of the message about Jesus from Isaiah is the fact that when he spoke, it was fulfilled, at least partially, to the people in the time of the people to which he spoke.
Well, if you think that might be why, if he sent Jesus into the world, because no mortal human being could do the things that he wanted him to do in order to lead the people in the right way.
Oh, absolutely. I think God did send Jesus into the world in human form because no mere mortal, no mere human being could do those things and could bring that redemption.
Tried and tried and tried through different human beings to get them to fulfill.
Yeah. God did try through.
But they just didn't prove out to be what he wanted.
Yeah, that's right, Wesley. God tried through many different, whether they were kings or priests or prophets.
Like right here when he said, till they present right offerings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in themselves more so than money.
Right. And they're talking about, he's talking about both, but you can't, what he says is, basically when he says about tithes later on, he's talking about the only way that you can really give what's proper and it be properly accepted is if you are right in your attitude first. So you're right. You have to become right or proper inside, and your attitude before what you give can really be effective and acceptable to God. So you are right. And he did work through all these different people, yet they failed. You're correct. And part of the reason, by the way, folks, that I repeat a lot of what y'all say is because we don't have a microphone set up down here. Ken and I have talked several times, and I've just never gotten in a microphone to set up. So, for those who are listening, unless I can take this thing and hold it up, this little mic here, and hold it up to your mouth. So, but Wesley, you're correct. He tried all those times through all kinds of folks, and they just couldn't do it because they were not right inside. And Jesus is the one that came and did that. So, a lot of people think that originally, or early on, thought that originally Malachi was the prophet himself. Because the role of the prophet was to do that, was to call people back to relationship with God. Later on, in fact, approaching the New Testament era, many of those within Judaism, and obviously later the New Testament gospel writers, as they looked back, equated Malachi the messenger with Elijah. Because remember, the belief was that Elijah would come and would announce the coming of the Messiah. And so they interpreted this, I am sending my messenger to prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, as Elijah the forerunner. And of course there were those who thought John the Baptist was the reincarnation of Elijah. Why? Because Elijah didn't die a normal death, according to the text. Elijah was carried up into heaven. And even when Jesus asks his disciples, who do men say that I am? One of the answers was, well, some of them think you're Elijah. Now, and in their minds, they're thinking, so, are we waiting on Messiah? Because at that point they had an incomplete understanding of who Jesus was. But one of the really bad things, or sad things, I think, within this early Old Testament theology, this priestly theology, was the separation between God and direct contact with regular folks. The religious elite had built this wall of separation. And in the temple, it was symbolized by that great heavy curtain that stood between the Holy of Holies and the worshipers, with the presence of God, the Ark of the Covenant, just behind that heavy curtain. So the original author didn't see my messenger as God incarnate, but another messenger that would come before God to prepare the way for God's coming. And that when God did arrive to judge and to once again bring righteousness, it would be suddenly and unexpected in a way that would not be anticipated. That's what he means here by the Lord will suddenly come to his temple. Not only will he kind of come out of the blue and catch them off guard, but at first they won't recognize it's the Lord because he's not what they expect. And certainly Jesus was not what many in Judaism expected. Now, the messenger himself is to come and purify the temple and the religious practices around the temple of their corruption. Corrupt practices to cleanse and prepare for the fullness of God to come. But notice where it says they are to start. The religious leadership. And that's what Malachi, just like Isaiah, just like Amos, just like Hosea, and so many of the other prophets from the 8th century B.C. on, Malachi recognized that much that was at the heart of the social ills boil down to religious ill and came to rest in the laps of the religious leaders, the sons of Levi, the priests, the ministers, those others who served in the temple and who had positions of leadership in the temple area, not just the priests but also the Levites who helped them and who took advantage of that authority. That's what he was talking about here. There were those who took advantage of their religious authority. And rather than sincerely trying to journey with the people, they tried to point the people in one direction while they went in another. And so what he says here is, first of all, before the temple can be cleansed of its practices, and before the fullness of God can truly be seen, the sons of Levi, all of those who serve in any kind of leadership capacity in religion, in their worship, in their religious practices and teaching, had to first find that justice and that righteousness and be cleansed. And trust me, it's very tough a lot of times to get religious leaders, not just preachers but others, but especially a lot of preachers, it's real tough to get them to admit that they're human. I still remember one of my favorite scenes in one of my favorite, and I'll put quotes around it, religious movies. It has to be in the movie Oh God, when John Denver goes to the crusade where the Reverend Willie Williams is running his crusade and his healing crusade and having the offering taken up, and he tells him he doesn't want to hear anything but the rustle of folding money. And George Burns, in the character of God, has sent this group of religious leaders have gathered together, and they can't believe that John Denver, this produce clerk or produce supervisor in a store has actually been visited by God. And so they give him all these tough questions to answer, and most of them are written in Hebrew. And so when he goes back to the room and George Burns comes in, he laughs, you know, at the fact that they've done this. But he gives him the answers. He said, but I want you to go to this Reverend Willie Williams, who says he knows the mind of God and he knows what God wants, and deliver them to him. And he has a conniption fit right there at this crusade when John Denver does that, and he sees these questions answered. He is one of those that, in fact, he raises a question earlier when a bunch of religious leaders called in John Denver, and he said, are you very religious? No. He said, do you go to church? No. Do you go to synagogue? Well, it's been a long time since I've been to church or anywhere. He said, then what makes you think that God would come to you rather than one of us? Even my Jew brethren over here, he says. That's the kind of religious leadership that was going on in the day of Malachi. And it's some of what we can see even today in our religious leadership. And what he's saying here is the first place that we need to start is with all of those who minister. But then again, we're all called to ministry. But we do need to hold not a separate standard, but we do need to hold those who minister to the same standards to which we are held.
Well, if everybody would minister the Word of God instead of their own interpretation, they would be better off with it.
They would. Of course, we have four Gospels with different views of Jesus because of different understandings. So there has to be some interpretive leeway in there, but it has to be, as we said, it's one of the key is being led by the Spirit in doing that, and not just because we think we have a unique idea or answer here.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. Ain't that the reason there's so many denominations out here today?
Most denominations, that's part of the reason there's so many denominations, but it's not so much that they split over important issues of theology as over the peripheral issues. Actually, most Christian denominations, when it comes to basic beliefs about God and humans and a need for redemption and Jesus being the Savior, they agree on those. It's all the other little things, the way we do this, the way we do that, the way we interpret this. So, that's a part of it. Is all of that. And so what he's saying here is, before God, who is seen as a majestic king, can come to his temple, which is his palace, before that can happen, the sons of Levi and the temple practice has to be set in order. And this messenger will straighten out the abuses and restore, in their mind, the golden era. When worship had dignity, when worship was entered into with sincerity. And yet, as I said a moment ago, and as Wesley mentioned too, if we would all minister and do our part, that would actually encourage even more growth. If we held each other to the same accountability, if we held ourselves to the same accountability, we won't hold somebody else. That might be the better way. Because a lot of us want to hold other people to a stronger accountability than we want to be held to. But if we level the playing field and we all held each other to the same accountability that we have, that would be a step in correcting. Harvard Church historian George La Piana, and it's P-I-A-N-A. It's not a mispronunciation of piano. But La Piana wrote a number of years ago, every religious movement passes through three stages: the moral ethical movement, the theological, and then the aesthetic. It begins with an instinctive moral reform, then goes on to the reflective formulation of faith and practice. Finally, it elaborates in terms of its own beauty, oftentimes in buildings and worship apparatus. The last stage marks a point when oftentimes there is intellectual arrest and the movement begins to be corrupted. The movement then must be born again in reformation with morals as intention. What Malachi is saying here is that the temple had become corrupted. The temple had gotten to the point and that the religious leaders thought they were above reproach. And he said, what God is saying as the refiner and purifier is He is coming to call back those people to morality and to weed out the decay. To weed out the decay and call them back to morality. To ethics. And really, ethics is the living out of your proper belief. Ethics and belief cannot really be separated. And if your ethics are poor, that says you got a pretty poor belief. If you have high ethics and morals, then generally, if you truly live those out, then generally your belief is along those same lines. So perhaps we should give hard thought to the substance of what we believe about God and other things, theology, and maybe argue less about the peripheral issues. I mean, that's why there are 32, then the United States government recognizes 32 different Baptist groups and conventions for tax purposes in the U.S. As I said in a paper I wrote, a presentation I did, my grandfather used to say that Johnson, Grass, and Baptists were going to take the South. And sometimes Baptists have been like Johnson, Grass, which is really a weed. We've done that. We should give more, and I think what he's saying here to these folks is they need to be careful and start thinking more deeply about their theology and what they believe about God and what they believe about humanity and its relationship with God and what they believe about their relationship with others, and worry less about the frills on the outside, the peripheral issues, to enrich their worship. And not just their worship in the temple, but their worship in life. The call is, just as God is active in refining us, we are also to be actively involved in refining our theology, our understanding of God. In the New Testament, when I was doing a lot of my study and my writing of my master's thesis, my professor, Major Professor Don Cook, said, there's a new book out, Stephen. I said, oh, it is. I said, what's it on? He said, well, it's by a fellow named Hans Herbert Stolt, and it's a criticism of the Markan hypothesis. That is, it's a criticism of the belief that Mark was the first gospel written. And there's a lot of evidence that Mark was the first of the four actually written. He said, but this guy's done it, and since your thesis deals with some things in the Gospel of Mark, you better at least buy it and read it and quote it in a couple of sentences. Or somebody on your committee who knows the book's out there is going to ask why you didn't. So I did. And the guy in there basically said that Mark was not the first one written. In fact, he said Matthew was written first, then Luke, and then Mark came in and did the Reader's Digest version. He chopped it up. He didn't say Reader's Digest. He used some other language. But I said, that doesn't work. Because what do we usually do as human beings? Do we, unless you work for Reader's Digest, do we condense our theology? Do we condense our learning? Do your students, do you expect them when they read a book and do a paper on that? Tracy, do you expect them to give you the bare minimum? I'll make it 2 pages. I know you could do a better job if you did 10, but you can only make it 2. Huh. We expand and expound upon. It's the same thing here. We're not to cut and stunt the growth of our theology. We're to be involved in refining it, in studying it, and in understanding new ways. And that's what he's talking about here. Refining the sons of Levi, who will then be like gold and silver. Why? Because the peripheral things are not the important issues anymore, but the basic theology has become stronger. To be open to being cleansed and refined. And that's not an easy task. Not just for folks who go to seminary. It's not an easy task for anybody to really sit down and chew on the text. Especially when we read some of those that we say, wait a minute, does it really say that? And the Bible's full of all those kinds of things. And it's full of things we'd rather not read. Kill all the men, women, children, and animals in this city. We don't want to read that. We get to that part in the Old Testament, we flip over somewhere else. Right?
Yeah, if you don't read it all, you don't get the full story.
That's true. If you don't read it all, you don't get the full story. And this story is not just about God. This story is about humanity and how we are to be in relationship with God, but how we have fallen away from that, not only relationship with God, but then the corresponding relationship with others, and how some folks got back to it and how some folks didn't. It reflects all of human nature. That's why this whole book has some relevance to our lives because and our world, because it reflects all of human nature. The good, the bad, and the ugly. If you ever watched that movie, you know why I did that. Yeah. I wish I'd only watched it once or twice. Fire also represents the presence of God. In Leviticus 6, 9 through 13, there are instructions that the sacred fire of the altar is never to be let go out. And in Leviticus 10, and also in the call of Isaiah, in Isaiah 6, we find that fire is the means of maintaining purity. It's the means of being cleansed. What happened when Isaiah had that vision? One of the seraphim flies to one of the braziers. With tongs, he picks up what? A red hot coal, that's right. And comes and touches that to his lips to cleanse his lips. Fire represents something that is hard and that we're scared of. And so when he talks here about being purified, God will come and refine us like a refiner's fire. It's meant to let us know that it's not going to be easy. Bless you. And it's something that we often fear because how many of us really want to look at our warts? And yet it's something that allows us to offer offerings in righteousness. That is proper offering, as you mentioned a while ago, Wesley, to be able to give to God that which is right or correct or proper. Those offerings that really befit God. How many times do we? And what was happening here is starting with the religious leadership and then others within the people of Israel were not offering things to God that were befitting of who God is. But like Cain in Genesis chapter 4, they were offering the leftovers to God and keeping the best for themselves. And so these offerings of righteousness are first of all to be ourselves and our attitudes when we have been cleansed. So, there are a lot of different thoughts on this. I know I've scattered them all around. But here in this passage, it is speaking, I think, of God coming as a refiner and a purifier. Bless you. A refiner and a purifier. And not just at the day of final judgment, but in the Messiah, the messenger who comes to refine and to purify. And sometimes to take us into those places where we deny and we come out weeping because we can't believe how far we've fallen. And yet even in that, in refining such people as Simon Peter, God was present, God was faithful, and God made him right. Cleansed by that fire. So, whoever wrote Malachi 3:3, I also know it's not my wife writing. So, I hope you're here tonight. I hope we got to that at least somewhere around what it means. If anyone has further questions or things that you'd like to offer, you say, well, I don't think that's what it means at all. I think it means this. That's okay too. Old Testament's not chronological. No. And actually, there were other books written after Malachi.
What's the last book in the New Testament before Christ?
Oh, last book in the Old Testament?
I meant in BC.
BC? Well, Daniel is probably... Daniel and Jonah are both late. Daniel is probably among the latter ones written. Some people put Daniel in the vicinity of 190 to 170 B.C. It's getting closer.
It's not that big yet, really, like the
less than a couple of centuries. And with Malachi, you're probably... Malachi, it's probably somewhere... probably somewhere around 400s, around the 5th century B.C. Maybe, at the latest, maybe 4th century, in the 300s.
Well, let me ask you, how come the Old Testament is not given to the chronological?
Well, it's because of the way it was collected over years. The way it was written over, the question was, how come the Old Testament is not chronological? Because of the way that different portions of it were written over centuries. Some of the oldest things, though not the oldest, some of the oldest material in the Old Testament in written form is Genesis chapters 2 through 11. It's actually 500 years older than Genesis chapter 1 in written form. But it's written between 1000 and 960 B.C. during the time of David. And Genesis 1 is probably not written until during the Babylonian exile or thereafter in the early 500s, mid to early 500s B.C. And so you've got different insights that come into these things and different books written at different points in time that are passed around among some, although oral tradition was the earliest form, but they're passed around among some, but then they don't make it to others until later, and they kind of get attached wherever. It's just like, even in the New Testament, you know, Matthew's listed first. The primary reason for that, when the church put together the books of the New Testament into a collection, Matthew, which is the gospel that also calls the Christian church the New Israel, Matthew was used by many churches as kind of a manual of how to function and the theology, etc. And it was used more than Mark, though Mark was probably written first, therefore it's listed first. Though it's written at least 15 to 20 years after Mark was written. The letters of Paul, as I believe we may have mentioned at one time before, the letters of Paul, first one we run into is Romans. But the first one written was 1 Thessalonians. They're not chronological, they're longest to shortest. That's the way the church put that together. When they started collecting the letters of Paul, they started with the longest one to the shortest one. That's the only rhyme or reason that they used. And that's why, and I've briefly mentioned before, but we really hadn't gotten into it a whole lot, but in 1 and 2 Corinthians, the church named them Corinthians Alpha and Corinthians Beta when they collected them. Paul didn't say this. In fact, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, he says, I wrote to you before about da-da-da-da-da. And now I'm writing to you again, which means 1 Corinthians is actually not the first of those letters. It's at least the second letter. And it's probably the second letter. 2 Corinthians is probably made up of pieces of four different letters. And if you look, sometimes you'll be reading something that Paul says, especially in 2 Corinthians, and you're reading along, everything seems nice, and then all of a sudden he's on them with both feet, like he's going to rip them to shreds, and he's threatening them, like, just wait till Daddy gets home. And then he goes back to everything's nice and wonderful again. He said, wait a minute, what's wrong with him here? Did he get up on the wrong side of the bed? Did somebody dump his Cheerios out on the floor? You know, I mean, what's going on here? But if we can identify some of those in a different sequence, suddenly you've got a series of four letters, and you see a progression that suddenly makes sense, and you don't have all these driving down a road at 70 miles an hour in drive, and I'm just going to push the clutch in, throw it in reverse, and pop the clutch. I mean, that's how you feel sometimes when you read some of Paul in 2 Corinthians. You're going along down this highway doing just fine, and then suddenly he throws it in reverse and pops the clutch. So, you know, as the church was collecting all of these things, in fact, the whole idea of the canon. The canon are those books that are the officially accepted books in as the standard or the norm. In the Old Testament sections, the Torah or law or instruction was not canonized until around 400 B.C. And yet it was written over several hundred years before that, over a period of several hundred years. But the first five books were not finally canonized as this is what belongs in the Bible until 400 B.C. The prophets, which included Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, and then the other ones we call prophets. The prophets were not canonized until 200 B.C., though some of them were written much earlier. And then the writings, which includes other things, including Daniel. Daniel's not in the Hebrew Bible, Daniel's not listed among the prophets. Daniel's listed among one of the later books. Isn't canonized, set as this is the end of the canon, the Hebrew Scriptures, until almost the end of the first century A.D. The New Testament, on the other hand, these books are starting to be written. 1 Thessalonians is the first thing written in the New Testament. It's about 50 to 51 A.D. through the end of the first, beginning of the second century. But there were other things that are in that we don't read out of typically in church that were written as well, that a lot of folks read, and some churches accepted them and cut out some of the things we've got here. The canon, the New Testament canon, wasn't set at those 27 books until around 367 A.D., and yet they were written between 50 and 100 or so. So that was, canonization was a long process as well as the written form. So that's why you find you'd be reading something and say, wait a minute, when was this written? Hold on, it's over here and it was written before this one that's listed over here. How can that be? Because of the circulation of oral tradition, then written copies in different parts of the world before they were finally brought together.
Do we feel you got most of it, or
the church pretty much settled on what they thought was the best deposit of the faith in what we've got here. Now, some churches obviously use other books as well. Some denominations use things in the Apocrypha, the Old Testament Apocrypha, that is between the two. Some of that writing compares rather favorably in the form and in the story with some of the later books in the Old Testament, but they didn't make it into the canon for various reasons. The Christian church as a whole would hold that those 27 books we have in the New Testament are the closest and best deposits of the earliest faith. Though there are some, and if you watch the Discovery Channel and the History Channel, or go into some bookstores or go into some college libraries, you'll find, well, if you walk down and look in my library, you'll find books that have some of those other writings in there too. Some of which I've done some study on to try and do a comparison and see should they be legitimately considered, or are they kind of out of whack with their theology. There were a lot of those things written. But the church, through church councils, through study, through prayer, through debates, through church councils, finally came to the point to where these are the things that, as we know the historical Jesus and His life and teachings, and as we know how the church formed early based on that and some of the teachings of Paul, these are the books that fit and these others don't. So, and books this thick have been written about how that happened. So, okay. I hear the alarm. I thank you for coming and for sharing your insights, for sharing your questions. As I said, next week, Vacation Bible School in here at 6 o'clock. Then when the children and their teachers go, we will pull out one more. In fact, there's only one in there left. I don't know what it is, but there's one in there. But if you want to add one, then we can. And then on the 22nd, we will start looking at the book of Revelation on Sunday nights. And what we will do with that is, there will be some assignments each time, some sections to read and think about and come with your insights and your questions so that I'm not doing all the talking or most of the talking. Several. Actually, if you read your newsletter, we've got about 7 or 8 weeks listed there. I think 7 weeks listed there into early August. If we need to go a little further, we can. We're not going to interpret every number in there, though. As you go, know this. We will never, this side of the grave, know everything that there is to know from here or from our relationship with God. But then again, reading this text and studying it and sharing it with each other, as well as our insights, just may be part of God's refining us and cleansing us so that we might present to God those sacrifices in righteousness, which will help the world to be a better place. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.